Tribeca, right next to De Niro, but I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra, and since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem, all of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's, took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus, driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my top. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. Nigga, I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from OG at a Yankee game. Shit, I made the Yankee hat more famous than a Yankee can. You should know I bleed blue.
I love that song.
Oh yeah, New York.
New York, man, what a great song. Well, this is the Q Report. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. And today's program is sponsored by TechServe.
TechServe, we have a drop. Guys, we're produced by Heather and Nat. Does the producer mic work? Are you guys on there?
Oh, we're on there. Oh,
okay, yeah. Here, I'm about to do a drop. Are you guys ready? Do you guys have all the buttons on?
Ready. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe. www.techserve.com.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait.
Oh, you got to save that.
I shot my load on that one.
Yeah, no. You got to save that. That's a very special thing. But
so,
anyway.
Katie, we have done some interesting quotidian things this week.
We did. We have done many interesting quotidian things. But
we actually went into Avery Fisher Hall, which is something you probably walk by 10 times a week, but
at least
don't go in as much. And so something that was quotidian in your life, you actually, penetrated and saw.
Yeah, got to have the experience of being in it and hearing the new revamped acoustics, because they've done a lot of work in Avery Fisher Hall over the last few years. And the acoustics were really good too, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was just, well, we went to see a concert, which Patrick was responsible for organizing for us. Thank you so much. And what we saw was an amazing Philharmonic Orchestra from Brazil.
Okay.
Conducted by João Carlos.
João.
I'll never get that Portuguese
Carlos.
Name down. Carlos. Martins. I do find that Brazilian, the Portuguese phonemes are really a challenge.
And they got the Olympics. I am so happy they got it.
I think it's great. Although I think they may find it a double-edged sword myself. But, we'll find out. I don't know any other country that has had a great experience with hosting the Olympics. I mean, it becomes a real, you make a lot of money in the short term and you've spent an enormous amount of money in the long term.
But remember what's left is like better transportation systems, increased hospitals. I mean, I do think you have to build something.
I mean, I know in Atlanta, when they hosted the Olympics, they razed the downtown section of Atlanta, tearing down hundreds and hundreds of old, beautiful buildings.
Well, that's not
and
good.
Building something called Millennium Park, which nobody goes to, and the rest of the downtown is a wasteland.
God.
Yeah, it sucks.
So, we have a very interesting show talking about quotidian things. Like, we have crows. They are everywhere.
We are, today's program, we are happy to have as a guest.
Blessed.
To have Leanda, I hope I'm saying that right, Leanda Linhaupt, who is the author of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. And Ms. Haupt is, I guess, something of a naturalist, certainly a great fan of ornithology and an observer of corvid or crow life. And this is a really lovely sort of extended essay on the observation of crows and crow behavior from an urban setting, as well as sort of observations about how we interact with the other animal species in our urban environment, and how most of us really don't pay that much attention to them, and yet all around us is this great cornucopia of animal life.
Give us an example of one that strikes you.
Well, besides crows, and we have pigeons.
I'm amazed at how many raccoons there are.
There are an amazing number of raccoons
in
the city.
They survive everywhere in Central Park.
Well, it makes sense that they like it here because there's so much food for them to forage from. But the other animals that you might not think of so readily are things like peregrine falcons, which make their homes in the steeples of churches and cathedrals and tall buildings. There's lots and lots of them
what
up
about
in my
that
neighborhood
one
on the Upper
85th
West Side.
Street?
That's right.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, 75th, right in front of the boat lake.
Pale Mail.
And actually, there was a famous CNN journalist. She used to have that prime time spot on CNN. She was blonde, kind of attractive. Do you remember who I'm talking about? Anyway, her husband had the bird removed from the facade of the building, and everyone went completely crazy. I was like, how could
someone
do that?
There were demonstrations out front of the building.
She should have been fired just for that. I mean, how can you allow your...
Why would you not want to observe something so fabulous?
Or you have to find a place. You can't just remove it. I mean, that's absolutely crazy. I'm happy she lost the show, because that was absolutely egregious to play... To be so removed from public opinion that...
Well, and so removed from nature. I mean, in the sense that you would actually resent the fact that these birds are, you know, dumping feces on your building. Well, you know, it rains. Guess what? I mean, would you rather have that, or would you rather have, like, you know, inches of soot and pollution from automobiles? I mean, what's the, you know, what's next? If you can't have a freaking bird nesting on your windowsill, I mean, you know, how far are we going to go in this lack of tolerance for the rest of the world around us?
How did you hear of Leander?
I read the review in the New York Times book review, which I do, you know, I subscribe to it, so I read it cover to cover.
You subscribe to the New York Times?
To the book review section only.
Really? They just deliver that little section to you?
Yeah, and you get
all
it
the way to your
earlier.
House?
Yeah, you get it in the mail. And I don't tend to read a lot of other news, New York Times articles anywhere but online, because I just don't want the paper.
God, it's so many pages.
It's so many pages. It's $5 to buy. I mean, for instance, today, Patrick, there was my brother called me up to tell me about the front page story on E. coli and the devastating effects of E. coli. And of course, there's an enormous amount of controversy in the news right now, and a lot of policy issues that are being decided in Washington around food safety. And people can really can and should tune into these issues. There are many places to go to look at them, depending on what side of the spectrum you come down on. But one of my favorite places to read about food policy is on a very conservative site that is run by National Cattlemen's Beef Association. It's called meetingplace.com.
Oh, yeah, I get that.
And they run a blog. They run a newsletter twice a day. And the people who write into this and blog onto these articles are incredibly conservative, incredibly knee-jerkish, kind of crazy.
Like James McWilliams?
Yes. But you learn, or Sarge Gravert, he's another one of my favorites who writes in all the time and is incredibly, he's been an old-time meat industry guy and totally against anything like country of origin labeling or traceability, or, you know, everything is an arrow aimed directly at the heart of the meat industry. For instance, this week, and I'll get off the subject in a second, but this week there was a lot of stuff in the news about the cap and trade issues about the kinds of emanations from, you know, carbon-based pollution. And so, of course, everyone on meetingplace.com, all the readers were like, well, this is just going to put us all out of business, blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, the article states very clearly that you have to be producing 25,000 metric tons per year of carbon-based pollution before you achieve the level of having to work with a cap-and-trade system. But they were all willing to just say, you know, this Obama government is ready to just kill us.
There's such little inch of improvement, you know, like removing automatic weapons from city streets. Yeah. I mean, they just go crazy.
Right. Oh my God, my right to bear arms, my constitutional rights are being taken away.
It's a reflection of, you know, ignorance affecting even their future generations.
That's right.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Well, we're produced today by Heather Hyman and engineered by Nat Wiener. So let's tune into the studio. Guys, do we have Leander on?
No, we're going to do music and get Leander on.
Okay, sounds
great. We'll take a break and we'll be right back with Leander, who wrote Crow Planet.
She's so fucking
happy again. Suki plays with Leo, Sasha plays with Brit, Adolf builds a bonfire, Enrico plays with it. They probably will in games without frontiers or without tears. If looks could kill, they probably will.
And we're back. This is, I know, it's fabulous. This is the Q Report. I'm Katie Kiefer. My co-host is Patrick Martins.
Hello.
We are engineered today by Nat Wiener and produced by Heather Hyman. This is the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by TechServe. And we have on the line with us from Seattle, Washington, Leanda Lynn Haupt. Did I say that right, Leanda?
It's actually Leanda.
Leanda.
Very close.
Thank
Hi,
you.
Leanda.
And Leanda is the author of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. This is a new release from Little Brown. Yeah, we're going to quiz you afterwards, Leanda.
Nice touch. I like it.
Absolutely.
What breed of crow was that? What region of the country did that crow come from? Can you tell us? Do you need to hear it again?
Are you serious?
No, I'm kidding.
No, we're kidding you.
I was ready to say, well, I think it's, you know, it's an American crow from the East Coast.
Are there different types of crows, or is there only one kind? All the crows that we see around the world, are they all descended from one variety?
Oh, you know, they're closely related, but there are many different kinds of crows and ravens all over the world. The kind that we typically see all over North America is the American crow. There are a couple different regional species here and there closely related to the American crow, but the ones I write about and the ones that we're seeing in our cities and suburbs are American crows.
And crows are uniquely well adapted to coexisting with man, and that's why we have so many of them in our urban environment?
That's right, because they're bold, they're intelligent, and they're omnivorous. They can get along in places where a lot of more sensitive avian species can't. And the reason intelligence comes into play is that, you know, as human culture and human places change so rapidly, crows, because they're so smart, have a great plasticity in their behavior. So instead of just acting constantly out of instinct, they can use previous experiences to sort of choose, you know, how they're going to react. So their intelligence is a component of what allows them to be so successful alongside humans.
So you're saying that crows have memories and they can pass those memories on to younger generations in terms of their behavior?
That's right. I mean, they certainly have complicated social and family groups, and they pass on learned behaviors to other generations. And an example of that in a kind of a new behavior among crows that we've seen in the last, really coming to the fore in the last decade, is the habit of dropping nuts. Or here in the Pacific Northwest where I live, close to the Puget Sound shoreline, the crows will drop snails onto the road and wait for cars to run them over so they can get either the nut meat or the snail meat inside. Yeah,
fantastic.
It is.
That is. Well, gulls do that also, don't they? Seagulls?
Well, you know, what gulls do, what you've probably seen them do, is taking things in shells up and dropping them on rocks.
Yeah,
or dropping them on
that.
A hard substrate.
Yes.
But gulls haven't taken that next step of using humans as a tool for helping them get into it by dropping it in the path of cars. So,
have any crows just learned to go straight to like a nut cracking shop or something like that?
That might be the next step. We'll have to wait and see. But I haven't heard that reported yet.
Let's talk a little bit about a crow communication, because just to go back to those cries, I remember when I was reading your book, which I really enjoyed, one of the things that you talk about is how they have a whole, you know, very complex and sophisticated language. And so, for instance, when we were playing those crow cries before, you describe in your book, like there's that one, and then there's one that's much more rapid, and then there's a whole gamut of other sounds that they make. So how your own observations have been to assign meanings to them, but is there like a real study of corvid language, and are people trying to figure out really how to communicate with them?
There is. There's all kinds of studies in that. And the sort of the seminal study took place way back in 1971. And in that study, the researchers, they learned 20 different crow vocalizations. And by learn, I mean they observed that there were these different vocalizations that crows understood amongst themselves. So we could identify these, you know, two long drawn out notes, for example, would be an assembly call. And when the crows, you know, made that call, other crows would come. There would be a long sort of shrill cry that would mean a predator is near. And again, other crows would come to assist in scolding the predator.
Why would they assemble?
Oh, they come flying in, and it's really...
But why? For what purpose?
Why? Oh, well, there could be different reasons. I mean, one could be, it could be the idea of a predator, but it could also be the presence of a food source. So reasons like that.
And do they have units? How big is a group of crows?
Well,
like, I know Heckle and Jekyll, they rolled alone, just the two of them, but like on average crows...
Let me come back to that. I just want to say one thing about crow vocalizations. One more thing. Even though those researchers learned 20 different vocalizations, they suggested, and modern researchers suggest, that crows have hundreds, possibly, of vocalizations that they understand among themselves that we don't understand yet. So it's very complicated. And if we watch them, we can carefully come to understand at least a few of these. And I think all of us have probably been know this. That you are too close to my chick or nest scolding call that, you know, we hear in the spring and summer. But as far as crow groups...
What's their social unit?
Yeah, it's interesting. It changes through the year. So right now in the autumn, the crows are flocking up with families, new young from this year. So the groups are sort of... The family groups that we had separate this summer are now coming into these great autumn flocks, and these flocks will continue growing, sort of coming together until, the end of October, November, they'll be at sort of their peak populations, and they'll settle into these autumn and winter roosting sites where they roost in the evenings. In the daytime, they'll spread out. They won't stay in these great flocks. They'll spread out. They'll scavenge for food. In the evenings, they'll come back into these great autumn and winter roosts. And then in the spring, they'll start pairing off, splitting up, and nesting in our neighborhoods. And during that time, people sort of wonder where the great flocks went. And the reason that they're not happening is that the crows become territorial in the summer, and they just protect a little area where they have their nests. And so they split off into family groups and come together. And so that's sort of very simplified version of the crow year.
Well, one thing that I thought was really interesting in the book was you mentioned how sometimes there are crow nannies, that a pair of crows will have another sort of junior or juvenile member who has not yet bred or mated.
Wow.
Crows mate for life, is that right?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny. Monogamy is used two different ways by ornithologists, and it's kind of confusing. They use it the way that we normally use it to mean that a pair is mated for life, and that's what crows typically do.
Wow.
Crows,
so romantic.
So do lobsters,
isn't it so
by the
sweet?
Way.
And they...
loons?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, loons also mate for life. I remember that from On Golden Pond.
And geese, and so a lot of birds
swans.
Do that. Although there can be little crow divorces, and you know, things like this. They're really cute, so their intent seems to be to mate for life, and they're really sweet in forming pair bonds. If you watch in the spring, they'll preen the backs of one another's necks. Hmm. They'll do that with their young. So they have this sort of, they'll speak in these little whispers. It appears that pairs will mimic one another's unique vocalizations to deepen their bond between themselves. But that thing about nannies is really interesting because crows don't mate until they're 3 or 4 years old. And so in that time, and this is really unique among just about any animal, but we see it occasionally in the very most intelligent animals and hardly ever in birds, that... an unmated young crow, it could be the young, a previous young of the parents, or a cousin, of the family will come and help at the nest of a pair. And they'll what they mostly help with is sometimes usually just sort of helping to guard the nest. They'll observe what the parents do, and they'll sometimes help bring food to the young. They don't usually sit on the nest. Usually just the female crow does that, but they'll guard the nest while the female goes off to get food or do whatever. And we used to think that it helped the parents. It helped them have a more successful nest. But now we know that it doesn't, that crow nests with or without helpers are equally successful. Hmm. But what's really interesting is that the crows that were, I love your word, nannies, go off and they have more successful nests themselves. So they really sort of learn by watching.
So in other words, unlike humans, they actually get training for parenting.
Exactly.
I remember my shrink telling me like 20 years ago that for the most important job of your entire life, we provide absolutely no training whatsoever.
Exactly.
So I was reading,
yes, the Crow Society does.
I was reading in your the thing that describes your book that they have certain skills that you've learned from them. Like, what would you say are some of their skills? Like, I mean, how do they, you know, play that tough game of surviving in urban environments?
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that I think that crows teach me is sort of how to coexist with the more than human world. I mean, one of the things about crows is, I want to say that crows are not my favorite bird. I mean, if you could see me, you know, there's people that have the crow earrings and the crow tattoos and the crow t-shirts.
It seems
and,
like it's taking a little too far.
Well, you know, I don't know, the crow people, I mean, they're, uh-oh.
I mean, I like crows, but geez, I'm not about wearing their brand, you know?
No, but, you know, for some people, I mean, there's a deep mythological cross-cultural connection with these birds that runs, it really is across time and across cultures.
Don't they talk about impending doom or misfortune? Isn't, like, right before, yeah. like, the wizard comes or the devil, it's like, ah, like the crow is always there almost as a witness to these things. I'm talking more in fantasy films, but historically, I think the crow is associated with bad luck, right?
They're associated very often. It turns. I mean, in some native cultures, again, cross-culturally, they can be associated with light and the bringing of light. But very often, and most often, they're associated with death. And that is because, I mean, there's a couple reasons. The main one is that we see them as scavengers. So we see them, and they're the most common scavenger that we, wild scavenger that we have contact with. So we see them even in urban places where supposedly we're separated from the cycles of nature and death. In crows, we see our connection to that cycle. We see them scavenging roadkill on the side of the road. But back at the time of the Black Plague, it was much worse because people saw them scavenging, you know, the bodies of their loved ones. So there were so many dead, and it was so dangerous to go out that the bodies were just being piled up. And so people would see crows scavenging human bodies. In times of war, from Renaissance Europe up to the American Civil War, again, crows were seen scavenging bodies. And so there was that very visceral connection, even though now, you know, we don't see that and are highly unlikely to. I think the connection sort of psychologically sort of remains. But crows aren't, you know, really more connected to death than any other animal.
They're just
been embedded in the mythology.
Yeah, I mean, I think of crows as a far more benign ornithological phenomenon, say, than a vulture, which really is kind of a gross thing.
You don't see vultures that much.
You see turkey vultures all the time as
really?
Soon as you get out of
on
New York City.
Side?
No, oh. But as soon as, I mean, New England has thousands of them. I mean, where I grew up, there's many, many turkey vultures.
Right, there are lots of turkey vultures in New England, but it's true. But in the city, you know, crows sort of offer us that connection. But I sort of like to lighten it by seeing it more as, you know, a connection to the circle of life from which we are so often separated in city places. And so crows offer us a great lesson, I think, to remember that, you know, they're a very common bird, very easy to see and easy to watch. But what they remind us of is that we live in places where there are also, you know, we live in a more than human world where they remind us that there are other more sensitive species that aren't as bold, that are always with us, and species that are more sensitive still, that that, you know, the more that we sprawl into green places, the fewer of those creatures that there are. So they're, I mean, I think they're a reminder for us to live respectfully and graciously alongside the non-human community.
And we have about 5 minutes left. I wanted to ask, like, where do they nest? I mean, traditionally, did you cover that? Like, where in the urban environment, I mean, do they need to be high, low, and who are their predators?
Yeah, those are great questions. So in urban places, although in the winter they'll hang out on buildings and, you know, eat French fries and stuff, in the summer the place that they nest are in trees, and they nest typically 10 to maybe 14 feet up in trees. And what's they're like the street trees, you know, that we see that are growing to, you know, the good kind of mature street trees that we see on sidewalks are perfect places for crows. And in urban places, they have pretty small territories. They're just, it's about one pair of crows for every, you know, few houses. So what's interesting is that in more rural places, they'll nest a little bit lower in trees. They'll nest about 10 feet up. In cities, they like to nest 12 to 14 feet up. So I don't know if that's because, you know, they're afraid of all these skateboarders going by or whatever, but they
the buses.
Yeah, exactly. So they protect themselves a little bit, but they have a lot of predators. So you will see them, and you've probably seen them doing this. It seems like they're crazy because they'll mob birds that are way bigger than them. They'll mob any hawk, an eagle, you know, they'll mob vultures, they'll mob, raccoons. So it seems like they're insane to be mobbing these larger animals, but red-tailed hawks out in New England, broadwing hawks, or on the east side where y'all are, and owls, great horned owls in particular, and raccoons, and cats, and rats are all serious predators on crows wherever.
Do they fight amongst themselves?
Pardon?
Do they fight amongst themselves?
Do they fight amongst
themselves? To the death? Like for mating or whatever?
Oh, you know, I mean, there's some, occasionally a rogue male will try to get in on a mated female, and the rightful mate will, you know, they'll have a little, usually a symbolic argument.
I see.
And, but nice. There Civilized. Are, because they're so social, that crows have developed great social intelligence, and it seems that they have we know that they have crow funerals. This is something that hasn't been described in the scientific literature because it's still deemed too anecdotal, but the reports of this similar behavior of crows gathering in silence around a dead crow.
I've been invited to one of those. It's very somber.
Was it kind of gothic, huh?
Yeah.
Very gothic.
So, and it seems
he
like they have a simple...
cape.
Right. Simple system of justice. And I've heard stories of crows killing another crow. It seems like it would take an egregious transgression of crow society, but I have never seen it happen.
But you have seen crows tending to a sick or wounded crow. I know you described that in the book. That was very interesting.
And that's very common, too, especially if it's young, to gather around an injured crow and care for it, really, to bring it food and to stay with it.
But that's not common in other bird species that I've observed.
It is not common.
No.
It's funny that the birds that live the best in urban environments are also the ones that kind of like people
that
themselves.
That mimic human behavior, you know, more, actually get or what social. We think of as human behavior, yeah.
Well, very interesting. I mean, you, Leanda, could be on... I mean, I have so many more questions. It's like with all these interviews that we do, it's like... I mean, we could have you on in 3 weeks and ask you 20 questions that we didn't touch upon.
Well, Leanda, we should mention the name of your book one more time. It's Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. It came out, in August, I think, right? Or was it last spring?
No, it just came out, you're right, 1st of August.
Uh-huh. And it was reviewed in the New York Times Book Review, if people want to see that. Are you doing any appearances? Are you going to be touring for the book or doing any local readings in Seattle? Or you must be doing Elliott Bay or something.
Yes, in fact, yes. It's even winding down since it's been a few months, but I'm off to Northern California tomorrow and a couple more stops in the Pacific
Fantastic.
Northwest.
Fantastic. Have you had a lot of radio time with this? I would think you'd be really in demand.
This was the most radio she's done today.
Yeah. This is the most radio I've done today, but it's true. I've been on, it's mostly public radio seems to be the most interested in. Yeah, but I've done lots of fun, talked to lots of great people.
One last question. Have crows ever been domesticated?
Oh, a lot of people have pet crows, and they have made wonderful, amazing pets. They mimic, they learn to talk. They can be very attentive and affectionate.
Hold on, I'm sorry to interrupt. We have our next guest on who is motioning like a crow in danger, saying that he has two crows. Mo Frechette, you're our next guest, but this is unbelievable. Really?
I've had two pet crows in my life.
Oh, and how was it?
They were awesome.
Yeah.
I lived in the suburbs of Detroit, and they were rescue crows that stayed with us for like 6 to 12 months. And one when I was really young and I don't really remember, and another one when I was a teenager.
And how did you keep them from flying away? You keep them in a cage?
We didn't actually keep them from flying away. I think they made an impression. They stuck with us through their young life. And then when the fall came, they flew away.
Because they do recognize human faces, Leanda says.
We could call them as well, and they would land on our arm.
Amazing.
Wonderful.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Unbelievable. Well, please come back if you'll have us. We'll have more crow sound effects.
Wonderful. Absolutely. I love it.
And Leanda, thank you so much for being a guest today. You can access your interview on www.heritageradionetwork.com.
Including all the tags.
You can put that onto your website. You can make a link there. And people can listen to this anytime they want to.
Fantastic.
And you've been a wonderful guest, and we hope to have you back, because I want to do a whole series of stuff about the natural world around
us. We did not
kind of
exhaust Crow Planet.
Well, not only that, we didn't exhaust the whole idea of connecting with the wilderness whilst being an urban inhabitant. And that was one big part of your book, which was so lovely, I thought. So.
All right. Well, anyway, we will come back with Mo Frechette in 30 seconds.
Thanks, Leanda.
Good songs.
So he's leaving the life he's come to know. Ooh.
He said he's going.
He said he's going back to find.
Going back to find.
What's left of his world? The world he left behind. Not so long. Said he's
going back
to a simpler place and time.
Right.
Oh, yes, he is.
Right,
now I'll be with him.
I know you will.
Oh, let midnight train to Georgia.
Leaving on a midnight train.
I'd rather live in his world than live without him in mine.
Well, we were supposed to have No Impact Man on the show before this one, and he continues to have no impact culturally or even on our radio station.
I'm afraid it's all over between me and Mr.
He
No
wasn't
impact.
Feeling well enough.
He was too tired. He'd had so much publicity, he didn't need any more.
I guess too much no impact means that he loses energy.
Well, I don't know what
it's
it means.
It's like when you sleep a lot.
It means that the guy doesn't understand how hard it is to get your book covered. Having done book publicity
Didn't
for 10 years,
like
I was
alone
like...
alone in a biosphere and now
no,
he
decided to live in
on the phone.
New York with his... Why are we even talking about him?
Why
I don't want to give him any
I just
more...
I just want to do a
I
shot again.
I don't want to give him any more
he
press.
He doesn't use toilet paper.
No, he doesn't use toilet paper. Wow. So maybe the walk to the phone was all like...
Yeah, he wasn't even going to be able to make it into the studio, but you know, let's not talk about him. He got plenty of press. He doesn't
Did
need
he?
Ours. Yeah, apparently.
I don't know if he really
made
a cultural
shift. Well, because he has a documentary.
Shift. whatever.
Whatever. Forget about him. We have a much more interesting guest in the studio.
Well, no, that was from before, the show before. I mean, Mo was scheduled, and we are going to talk mail order with Mo.
Yeah, lucky for us, we have Mo Frechette, right?
One of the foremost mail order experts.
With the Zingerman's Company, which is one of the great mail order companies in the United States.
I always find it fascinating because every single farmer I work with, I'm like, so, what's on your future plans of growth? They're like, mail order. And I'm like, do you know anything about mail order? They're like, no, you know, but it is a secret profit generator, you know, that people wish they could handle do if they knew how.
If you can handle the transportation aspect of it. I mean, I think the biggest challenge with mail order is being able to keep your food fresh and getting it to its customer fresh. And I'm sure Mo has a few things to say about that chain.
Tell us about mail order.
What is it? On the one hand, one of the most difficult parts, I would say, is getting food there in shape, tasting good. But there are lots of foods that travel really easily. Like if you put something in a tin or a jar or a bottle, that's really easy to ship for the most part. Mm-hmm. Really the hardest thing for most farmers and people who don't have a store or a shop that has foot traffic is actually getting customers to shop with you by mail order, because it's out there on the web. There's no reason for anyone to come visit you. Unless they have some reason to come visit you, which is often because they visited a shop, they learned about you, and they learned that you could do mail order by first visiting your physical space.
Is that how? So is most of your mail order customers from, like, students and, you know, parents and professors from Ann Arbor?
That's definitely how we grew it from the beginning. Mm-hmm. It was the walk-through traffic at our shop that got our names.
And because it's a university town, those people would go back to their homes, and it started a core group.
Yeah. One thing great about a university town is the people keep changing. Mm-hmm. So you always
you
have new walk-through traffic.
Yeah,
true.
New
crop. And then how
year.
Have you found names since?
The most common way for a big, you know, I'd say big, but a medium-sized mail order company to start getting names is to join a cooperative where we all put our names in, and almost every catalog company in America has their names in these cooperatives. And the cooperative's kind of bread and butter is to look at all the names and say, well, if they buy at Zingerman's, they're likely to buy at Dean & DeLuca or Zabar's or some other catalog. So they run, you know, statistics and regression and crazy stuff.
And are these run by people like you, or are they independent firms that do that work for you?
Independent. Yeah, they're like, you know, just like UPS does our shipping, the co-ops do our list kind of acquisition part.
Is there a place where our listeners can go to learn more about mail order, like where the stuff is?
Yeah, well, the co-op lists, the most common one and the biggest one that I would start anyone with would be Abacus. You can find them online. The one thing with getting a co-op list is, though, you have to have a list to start. You can't put in zero names and expect to get any out.
Right. So you have to start knowing that you're looking for Zingerman's, and then it will the Abacus site will show you related businesses or businesses that are somehow tangentially
or you can't
to
get
yours.
Any names until you give names.
You can't. Yeah, you've got to join and you've got to give names.
Ah, you have to join.
Yeah.
And you can't really buy. That's more of a trading organization.
Well, you're not buying a mailing list from them.
You are
you're trading.
You are in effect. So what happens with me is I give my, you know, let's say I give them 50,000 names from Zingerman's who are customers.
Oh, I see.
Mine,
so
right?
you're trading your mailing list for other people's mailing list.
I put them in the pool as a kind of point of data.
Uh-huh.
And that point of data helps that co-op make better pools of data for people to kind of select names from.
Can so what, you stop? Can you block someone? Like if they were like, we're going to give you,
yeah.
do they tell you, oh,
yeah,
we're
yeah.
about to give your names to?
No, we can stop, definitely stop from putting that name into a co-op, and we do. And the other thing is that if the co-op, if that person's name exists on a block list, the co-op won't include them and they won't share them with other people either. They're pretty privacy, careful about privacy because they have to be in this industry.
Right. I bet. And then tell us just about Zingerman's mail order and other mail order businesses. I mean,
how many catalogs do you mail out every you mail out about once a month, right? I'm on your list.
Yeah.
So I get them pretty often.
You know, if you're the buyers get our catalog maybe every 6 weeks, a little bit more during the fall when the holiday season comes because it's our big season, and a little bit less in the summer when it's really slow.
Right.
But each time we mail, right now at our size of our company, we're mailing between 50 and 80,000 catalogs per drop.
Woo.
And then the biggest drop of the year is actually that rental, those Abacus names. And we rent names. And this year we're mailing, you know, close to 500,000 of those.
Wow.
That's a really big mailing. We spread it out over multiple mailings so that, you know, if anything happened during that week that they arrived.
Which are your best seasons that might surprise people? I mean, obviously Thanksgiving, Christmas. I mean, most mail order companies make most of their profits in the last few weeks of the year.
Yeah. Right? Most food mail order companies are kind of stuck to being a holiday, like a December business. Uh-huh. It's few and far between where the company doesn't have the majority of their business there, which, and by majority, it can range from us. We're on like the easier side of the majority, which is about 40 or 50% of our revenue in December, mm-hmm. and then there are ones that are go even higher to 90% of their revenue wow. in December. Which
yeah,
is
like
terrible.
Harry and David probably are one of those.
Yeah, I think Harry and David is the one I've heard is near 90%. Yeah. Although I don't
we're
know
very
for sure.
flat actually. Mo was looking at Heritage Foods USA's mail order campaign and noticed that we were unusually flat,
except it's for your like, turkey business.
Except for the turkey, it's not like we're making much money at any point in the year, but at least we're flat. At least we're getting consistent.
Meaning
orders.
That it's consistent over the course
That's
of,
what
the,
you
of
want.
The year. Yeah, you want to be getting those orders all year
we
round.
We have that. We just don't have profits or organization or tracking.
So if you're...
We're going to change that.
With you guys, what
I
you
hope.
Are...
It's up to Heather.
People buy food from you.
Right.
And they buy it for themselves to eat at home. So that's kind of flat because you eat at home all year round.
Exactly.
So if you're a gift business, though, you'll follow the gift holidays. So you'll be a big Valentine's, Mother's Day, Father's Day, Easter, whatever kind of food you sell that fits into a holiday. Maybe Rosh Hashanah or something. You're gonna hit those holidays.
Now, tell us about, you know, I know, you know, shopkeepers. You know, I know Zingerman's one of the best delis in the world. And, you know, I see shopkeepers everywhere. Technically, you're being a shopkeeper to people who you never see.
Ever.
I mean, how do you develop and keep and strengthen and keep alive relationships with people via such anonymous, you know, like an email or a catalog? Like, how do you do good customer service by mail?
Boy, that's a lot of questions. One is
your catalog is really cute and user friendly. That's one thing.
One thing is
marketing is really good on that.
You need a catalog.
If you don't print something and mail it to someone, you're usually leaving money on the table. Mm-hmm. If you're a web only business, you can usually do web and mail something too, and you'll find that the revenue you gain far outweighs the cost of that mailing. And so for us, we've been in print because we existed before the internet. So we've been in print, we've stayed in print, and we think that it's probably going to continue in some form or another ongoing because there's things that print can do that a website can't. Like it's portable, our catalog, you can pass it along to friends. You can read it on downtime. You can read it on the subway. You can carry it around. You can let it sit around for a while and come back to it later, which is really nice. And that allows, you know, it kind of reinforces and reminds people to shop with us.
Do you really hand deliver Parmigiano Reggiano?
I will.
For $2,500? Do I get a discount because I'm just in Brooklyn a few miles from you?
No, because I got to get it here from Ann Arbor.
That's cool. That's customer service.
The other thing you were asking is just how do we connect with emails and so on. And the other thing, one thing I'd say is we've always kept our phone system and our people on the phones really trained about the food that we sell and really concerned about spending as much time as they can with customers. And I think that that's opposite of most of the industry where there's these statistics that people measure themselves by, which says how little time did you spend talking to a customer because that makes sure that you're, you know, adding to the bottom line of the company. And we always train on the exact opposite, which is, you know, you try to maximize the amount of time you can spend with a customer to find out what they really like to eat, what they haven't tried that they might want to try.
I mean,
and
just
so on.
Calling Zingerman's, like if I would call Zingerman's and you'd be there,
yeah,
just the hello is already like I'm 30 seconds into my phone call from the customer. But what tactics do you use to keep? I mean, I'm really asking all this, you know, with an eye towards listeners who do a search on our site for mail order, you know, and then they learn, you know, all about these things. I mean, what tactics do you use? Like, what product will you push based off? Is there a list that you create? Hey, if they buy an olive oil, push this. Or if they buy a pork chop, push the lamb chop, you know?
Yeah. Well, the idea behind direct mail and is that you like something in particular about our company and that, you know, I'm mailing this because, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to mail advertise or to put up advertisements on billboards or anything else. It's like Patrick is interested in Zingerman's food. Patrick contacted me about Zingerman's food, and therefore I'm mailing Patrick about Zingerman's food. So my job, once you become a customer of mine, is to find out what you like and to regularly mail things that you might not know about so that you might be interested in buying them.
Right.
And so one of the things we do is look up, for example, in the spring, olive oils turn into, you know, we start using up the last of the last harvest and start using the new harvest. And there's a lot of those olive oils that a customer like Patrick, who loves olive oil, might want to know about that we're offering at a great deal.
And what about the fact that it's getting older?
Well, it's certainly, there's quality issues in the long run. But if you're a really good olive oil user, you recognize, like, A, I'm probably not going to use this oil for my top tier oil, my like finishing oil. But if I'm getting a great oil at half off, that starts to compete with cheaper oils, and I'm going to buy some of it because it's still a better oil than what I'm going to get at the supermarket.
Right.
And so my job is to find out what you like and to keep making sure that I give you interesting and new fun stuff.
How do you find new products, Mo? I mean, how do you guys just go to all the fancy food shows, or are people approaching you all the time with new stuff, or
both?
Both of those things.
Both of those. And then there's a little bit of the glamour part of business, which is far less than people think, but you do visit places, you visit people who make food, and you find things on the road, whether it's here in America or abroad. But a lot of it is grunt work. I mean, we have tastings with our crew. All of our crew is invited, and we do them about once every 2 weeks. And at that kind of tasting, we'll have 50 or 60 foods that people we found or people have contacted us or so on. And if one or two of those goes on to become something that we carry, that would be a big day. That would be great.
Right.
For us, it's typical where we'll go through 50 or 60 and say, you know, none of them are better than what we have right now, or there's not a really compelling reason to carry them.
In the artisanal, bracket with people who are sending you, say, samples of, you know, their favorite, you know, their mom's lemon curd recipe or something like that, do you then direct those people to a co-packer or somebody who's going to manufacture it for them? Or, I mean, how do you assure the quality of a product like that so that you know that it's going to be consistent every time you buy it for your customers? Yeah. That's got to be a really tough challenge.
Well, most of the folks that we have are down the road. They already have a business. They don't have...
I see.
They're not just having an idea. And usually I'm not involved with people who just say, you know, I've got this idea and I'm making it. It's usually, you know, you've got to have it in a jar with a label on it, available for sale.
It's got
to
be
hopefully
certified
to someone else before me.
Right.
You'd be like saying, Mo, come on, be on our radio show, but we have no equipment.
Well, no, but I mean, I think people think that they can. I mean, I know somebody who just started a granola business, for instance, and she really did go from nothing to, and now she's really processing an enormous amount of, she's still doing it out of her home.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's looking for a co-packer now. She's looking for all of that stuff. And eventually she may end up on your doorstep.
But, yeah. Well, lots of people seek advice from me and other people in the business at various stages along their life. And I always welcome it. I love talking to entrepreneurs and helping them through that kind of startup stage of their business.
Yeah, because I think it's very challenging. I mean, this, I don't know that much about it myself, but this woman has been, you know, using me as a resource. And I mean, I'm you know, only know as much as I know from when I tried to do it myself and just was completely, you know, shut down by sort of the logistics of working with meat and shelf stable and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's a difficult process to get to the point where you would be selling it to somebody like Zingerman's, I suspect.
It is. And I mean, starting a business from scratch, no matter what it is hard. When you have to involve yourself in food, it's even
more
complex.
Yeah, there's a lot of regulations around it. And then there's also a lot of, well, this is another conversation that's about supermarkets. We won't go there. But I have another question for you. What do you see as sort of the trends?
I knew it.
Yeah, I know. Patrick is always teasing me about my trend questions. But, I mean, it is interesting how things go in trends in the food business, and they really do. Like, groups of ingredients become very hot and groovy, and everybody wants that. And suddenly there's like a million balsamic vinegars, or there's a million, you know, lemon curds or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So what do you see, like, over the course of the years? Like, do you see, for instance, a big uptick? Right now we were talking earlier, Patrick and I, about the fact that that salumi, that, you know, preserved meats, cured meats and stuff like that, are having a big comeback in the United States.
Yeah.
Do you see a big uptick in your business for that?
Well, certainly there's a lot more people making salumi out there that can actually deliver it to you on time and in the quantity you want.
Uh-huh.
That's the hard part for those guys, is they have a product like that has a curing time that varies. And so for you to say, I want a case now, and they're like, well, I don't have a case now. I've got a case in a week or 2 weeks. It's very difficult for them to manage. So I've met a lot of salumi makers who make a great salumi but just can't deliver it on time and accurately. And that's a really difficult part.
How about the consistency of the product?
Up and down, I would say. Some are better than others.
Yeah, sure.
You know, a year ago, someone asked me like, what would you do if you were like in the food industry right now? And I said, for me, I would probably start a butcher shop. Like, I think that nobody's doing great butchery anymore. And the ones that are kind of fading. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of young people getting into it.
That's actually changing here in Brooklyn.
It sure is. It was like a year later they started coming out.
Yeah. And the Times ran that article. And yeah, I know, it's fascinating.
Right now, just looking around to me, I always look at what the opportunities are by things that are kind of fading, but still taste good and should be around. And so I look around at Jewish foods in New York, which seem in short supply of high quality. Like there's nobody making really great sandwiches with Jewish foods in them.
We once did a blind taste test of all of the cured meats of New York delis, and the pastrami and another one were won, by New York delis, but the corned beef was won by Zingerman's.
Really?
Yep. It was an interesting
And that was something that you guys are actually making yourselves?
We don't make ourselves.
You don't have a curing process.
No, we don't do it ourselves. We work with a guy named Cy Ginsberg out of Detroit. But,
sounds Jewish.
But a good Jew.
Yes, absolutely. But Cy started in 82, which is the time that we started Zingerman's Deli, and we kind of grew up together. And so, I think we've had that virtuous feedback cycle with each other where we wanted, it's tasting this way, Cy. Maybe we can make it a little bit more like this, and so on. And so I think the corned beef's gotten better over time, and fantastic. Thanks to us two working together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, fantastic. let's see, Mo's big head is blocking the thing. We have three more minutes. And I wanted to know about secrets. Are there any secrets that you have, like things that people would maybe go against what people would instinctively think? With mail or a lesson or an old wise tale or something?
Well, the one most common mistake for people getting into the mail order industry is that they're afraid of sending mail to people who buy from them regularly. And the kind of counterintuitive bit about mail order is that the most likely person to buy from you is the person who just bought from you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can almost never over mail your best customers. Which you probably recognize if you're like a big Victoria's Secret customer, or if you're a big J. Crew customer. You get those catalogs constantly. And you use them. Those are really smart organizations, and they know mailing you regularly, keeping you in touch, is going to keep you a better customer. So if you've got good customers in your mail order, don't be afraid of mailing them a lot.
Yeah, and you have to invest in order to be successful. I mean, if you don't send anything to anyone, it's very hard to keep their attention. Well, very interesting. And do you have any new things that, I'm looking here at the Zingerman's mail order guide.
What's hot for Christmas?
What are you going to be pushing?
Well, certainly my partner Ari's new book.
Ari Weinzweig?
Yep. Ari Weinzweig's Guide to Better Bacon, which is, I think, one of the first books in America about what is America's greatest fat.
He calls bacon. It the American olive oil, right?
Yeah.
And it includes 42 recipes?
42 recipes just out in July of this year.
And I think Ari came and talked about
that. He did. Yeah, we had him on.
And we self-published it, so it's not going to be in every bookstore everywhere this fall. So it'll make a really good gift if you want to give something unique to a bacon lover.
That's right.
Since you're doing it yourselves, can someone just buy like the bread section or something like that? I just like pages 4, 11, and 19.
Yes, of course.
And how many people are needed to run someone was going to aspire to be a $500,000 mail order company or a $1 million mail order company. How many people do you think they need to plan for?
When we were a 500,000 or a million, 500,000, we were just a few people most of the year. It's if you have a spike, that's when you're going to need more people. And I'd always hired at the holiday for extras. Nowadays, I'm hiring in the hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. But back then, it was in the 5 to 10. You can usually scrounge around in five, find a few people.
And do you, obviously, in your pricing, you include tasting samples for the very people that are going to be doing the customer service on the phone, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's important.
They know all the food inside and out.
That's great. Well, this has been very, very interesting. Where can people, what is the Zingerman's mail order website?
Zingermans.com.
Zingerman's.
Yeah, just go to Zingerman's. Just Google Zingerman's, and all the information you want is right there.
Yeah, the Google. It will give it to you.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Heirloom Michigan apples are back for the third season. So I always think it's fun to taste terroir.
That was a farmer who wanted to do mail order.
Wow.
And he actually could produce the quantities you needed in the time frame that you wanted.
He ships from his farm.
Uh-huh.
We send him the orders three times a week. And I think he's a wise farmer in that he said, you know, I want to get into mail order, but I don't want to do mail order.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I grow apples and I can ship some apples, but I don't want a website and an e-commerce division and a customer service department and so on. And so he asked us to say, well, why don't you do my apples during the apple season?
During apple season.
Yeah. And what about brownies? Did you bring any with you?
No.
Oh, man.
I suck.
Those are good, the brownies.
I've never tried the brownies, but well, I've sent many a Zingerman's basket in my lifetime.
This is hopefully the first of many of Mo's, contributions to the network. We're still in the works of trying to convince him to do some type of new show or seminar, you know, on the radio, which is a kind of definitive go-to guide for mail order, which I think, again, not just for food, but especially for any little small food producer. I think the lessons that would be contained therein would be very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Mo Frechette from Zingerman. Did I say that right, Frechette?
It is.
From Zingerman.
You mispronounced Zingerman. It's Zingerman. You got Mo's name right.
Thank you, Heather, our producer, and Nat, our engineer.
And thank you to TechServe,
our sponsor, for the Q Report on Heritage Radio Network. See you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'll be here next week.
Yeah, I'm out that Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pull me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Best Stop. Home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata. Still sipping my ties, sitting courtside. Knicks and Nets give me high five. Nigga, I be spiked out. I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely leave from.